Members, we'll call the this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. If we could get all members to come in and take their seats. Representative Murdoch, would you be kind enough to move the minutes? And I would also like to express the committee and my personal appreciation for you wearing a necktie today to honor the governor. And we see you're back to form here with no necktie. It's just good to have you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to be back without a tie. It lasted 5 minutes after the state of the state, so don't tell the governor. Yes, I'd like to move the minutes of our last meeting.
Thank you. Representative Murdoch moves approval of minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes pass. Thank you, Representative Murdoch. Members, we are going to we're going to hear from Representative Pepin on the nuclear moratorium bill. I will move the Senate file first, Senate file 4, and then since Representative Pepin is not on the committee, I will move that, and then I will move a delete all amendment, which everybody should have in their package. The delete all amendment does nothing other than insert the House language for the instead of the Senate language. And with that, okay. Do we need to move the amendments? Okay. Any questions about that? We're just inserting the House instead of the Senate language, so we're working off of the House file.
Okay.
Seeing no questions, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? None opposed. We are now working off of the House file. Representative Pepin, go ahead and present your bill. And members, what we're going to try to do here is for the proponents, we're going to use about 25 minutes. And for the opponents, we'll go proponents first after Representative Pepin. We'll give each side about 25 minutes and then get into the amendments. So with that, Representative Pepin, take it away.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing this bill today. House File 9, very simply, removes the ban on the construction of new nuclear power facilities, a ban that's been in place in the state for nearly two decades. I bring this bill forward because I'm extremely concerned about meeting our energy needs in the future. The United States Department of Energy has estimated our electricity needs will increase by about 25% by the year 2030. While that may seem like a long way off, if we are to meet that demand, we must start planning now, as the planning and construction process takes many years. If we fail to plan and provide the infrastructure we need in the future, we risk not being able to provide the energy needs we've all grown accustomed to, like lights and warm houses, to all the people of Minnesota. I understand there are concerns with nuclear power, and I feel strongly that we should continue to pursue renewable sources of energy, like wind and solar. But renewables alone cannot meet our energy needs, since they are not reliable and must have a backup. Nuclear power currently provides nearly 30% of our electricity in Minnesota, and is one of the few sources of baseload power. Therefore, it must remain part of the energy mix. Mr. Chair and members, thank you again for hearing this bill today. I look forward to a good debate, and I ask for your thoughtful consideration, and I hope my short comments will allow lots of time for good, thoughtful testimony.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. Brevity is always appreciated. Do you know who you want to have testify first for the proponents?
I don't have the list. But
whoever wants to go first, whenever you're ready, please identify yourselves for the record and take it away.
Thank you, sorry, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Hinkle, and I'm with the Minnesota Utility Investors, a grassroots organization of nearly 27,000 members. Most of you know our members from the variety of meetings that we hold around the state, and our members are the retail mom-pa shareholders of the 7 investor-owned utilities operating in Minnesota. On behalf of our members, I strongly encourage you to support Senate File 4 with the House language. We are encouraging you to look long-term and allow all of our baseload options to be at the table when determining how to meet our future energy baseload needs. From our members' perspective, very simply, they want the discussion. MUI members have a lot of interest and a lot of questions about this issue, and they want the discussion of nuclear energy to be an option in addressing our future. MUI has been working with quite a diverse group of organizations supporting this legislation. We have a variety, including the Minnesota State Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades, the Minnesota Pipe Trades, the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters, the Grassroots Organization of Sensible Energy Solutions, Associated General Contractors of Minnesota, Minnesota Dakota's Chapter of the National Electrical Contractors Association, and us, the Minnesota Utility Investors. We've all been working together very diligently in support passage of this legislation, and I'd strongly encourage you to support the House version of Senate File 4.
Thank you. Go ahead. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bride Seifert. I'm the manager of energy policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As Annette pointed out, we are a group that goes across both aisles that's garnered a lot of support for this bill. The chamber represents over 2,300 business members with over 500,000 employees. We're just asking today for you to support Senate File 4 with the language of House File 9 and allow the utilities and the PUC to make these decisions about Minnesota's energy's future needs, or Minnesota's future energy needs, sorry about that. All this bill does is allow a conversation to take place when we need that additional 24/7 baseload power, which we will in our future.
Thank you. Whoever's next, go ahead. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm Scott Gale. I am the business manager representing the Minneapolis Building and Construction Trades Council. We're a council, we're an organization that's made up of more than 16,000 construction workers out of my council alone. And for the sake of those who may not be familiar with what the Building Trades Council is, we represent those members. We're your neighbors that put on the hard hats and tool belts and strive to go to work every day building our homes and schools and hospitals, roads, bridges, and wind turbine generators, etc. I'm also here speaking as a resident ratepayer living in Sherburne County, only about 17 miles away from one of the two operating nuclear power stations in our state. I'm here to ask you today, ask members of this committee to, excuse me, to fully support House File 9 as presented. We feel Minnesota needs to have nuclear as a legitimate part of the discussion pertaining to the future energy needs of our state. We also believe that the Public Utilities Commission will responsibly and diligently debate the best options for Minnesota's future energy portfolio. I understand that permitting and constructing a new nuclear plant alone can take at least 10 years or longer, and that's not taking into account the preliminary discussions, studies, and diligence that would take place if a utility were to consider moving forward with that option. I understand that in any energy option, be it wind, solar, natural gas, hydro, or nuclear, added to the power generation mix creates jobs for our members and are all essential parts of a comprehensive energy policy. We also feel that if we are truly committed to reducing carbon emissions, that nuclear energy needs to be a part of that policy. And as our state stands today, Minnesotans' hands are tied, are somewhat tied where it pertains to the full and thorough discussion around responsible expansion of baseload power generating sources to meet our future needs of Minnesota's energy consumer and the job creation that will result from any such expansion. We need to free our hands so that we can have those discussions. So please consider that nuclear power is clean, nuclear power is reliable, nuclear power is a proven technology, and nuclear power is a large contributor to Minnesota's baseload energy source. And we believe that nuclear power is proven safe. In summation, I respectfully ask that you lend your support to the passage of House File 9 and afford Minnesota the ability to explore all viable options for its future energy policy. And Mr. Chair, representatives, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to address you today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Mansell, and I work for Westinghouse Electric Company. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about repealing Minnesota's nuclear moratorium. I work in marketing strategy for Westinghouse Electric Company, located here in Shoreview and Hutchinson, Minnesota. For those of you familiar with the Westinghouse name, we do not make light bulbs and refrigerators. Westinghouse's function today is solely to design, build, and maintain commercial nuclear power plants. At our facility in Shoreview, we build equipment that moves new and spent nuclear fuel in and out of the reactor vessel. In Hutchinson, we build large overhead cranes for use in the world's newest and safest Generation 3 plant design. The first of Westinghouse's Generation 3 plants is being built in Sanmen, China, as we speak. We sell our products all over the world to utility companies in Asia, Europe, Africa, and North America. Recently, we signed large contracts for our equipment at two plant sites in China. These are exactly the same designs as we are planning to build in Georgia and South Carolina. As exciting as all of these new opportunities are, it is disappointing that there is no market for our products in our home state of Minnesota. Not only do we not have a market here, but we can't even have a rational discussion about safety, cost, and disposition of spent fuel. This bill is not about asking you for permission or funding to build a plant. It is simply about allowing us to have a valid conversation about Minnesota's energy future at a time when we have the time to make thoughtful, informed decisions about which sources are best for our state. We need to keep in mind that all energy sources have pros and cons. Coal is abundant and relatively inexpensive, but the control of chemicals emitted is increasingly expensive to implement and enforce, to say nothing about safety risks associated with the mining and transportation of coal. Natural gas is acknowledged as cleaner than coal, but both coal and natural gas emit carbon dioxide. Meanwhile, the longer-term environmental impacts of accessing natural gas are being increasingly questioned. Wind is nominally both clean and free, but it's not baseload power. We only get energy from wind when the wind blows. The same goes for solar power. We only get energy from the sun when it shines. And that is irrespective of the environmental impact of the materials and chemistry utilized in solar panel manufacturing. We hear a lot of discussion about spent fuel and proliferation, but as we know, nuclear energy is heavily regulated and closely monitored to prevent its misuse. Its entire waste stream is completely controlled. At the end of the day, we must acknowledge that nuclear energy is clean and provides the baseload energy that Minnesota will need for its businesses to remain competitive. You should know that not only am I an engineer from the University of Minnesota, I'm also a mom and was born and raised in the state. We hear about the cost and the danger of nuclear waste, and the gut reaction, the easiest response, the safest position is to avoid it. But what alternatives exist for clean baseload power? Unfortunately, we have to step up to the plate and get our minds around the facts, the science, the cost, and the advantages of nuclear energy. Nuclear is a viable energy source. Countries all over the world have nuclear power plants, and many are actively building new plants. And why are they building? Because there is a need for clean baseload energy, and they know that spent fuel can be managed. In fact, we've been safely managing spent fuel since nearly the beginning of nuclear power in the 1950s. Westinghouse provides over 200 highly paid jobs in manufacturing and engineering in Minnesota. Just last year, we constructed a new manufacturing facility in Hutchinson, which started out with 6 employees and has already grown to 25 employees in less than 1 year. We would love to be able to expand our business to meet the market needs of Minnesota. New nuclear power initiatives in Minnesota could grow jobs at both of our locations. Before finishing my comments, I'd like to let you know that I lead Westinghouse Par Nuclear's chapter of an organization called Women in Nuclear, or WIN. WIN is a nonprofit organization whose primary objectives are to support careers in the nuclear industry and to provide accurate information to the public at large about nuclear energy. To that end, in addition to talking to various high schools about nuclear energy, we've also organized an opportunity that I hope you will all consider attending. Because spent fuel is such a hot topic in the nuclear discussion, and because we don't always know what information is correct, we have invited a health physicist to talk with us about the real risks associated with managing spent fuel. Our speaker, Allie Simpkins, has 19 years of collective experience in the areas of environmental assessment and nuclear safety analyses. She worked on Yucca Mountain while at the Southwest Research Institute Center for Nuclear Waste Regulatory Analyses. She will speak about the technical aspects of managing spent fuel with the intent of allowing the audience to make up their own minds. The event is scheduled for Friday, February 18th at our Shoreview facility, and we have sent invitations to each of you. I hope you'll be interested to come. Thank you again for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you. Members, questions for any of the proponents of the bill? Quiet group today. Thank you very much. We will move to hear from the people that are opposed to the passage of the bill. And I don't know if we have a distinct order, but we could start with Mr. Cooper from the University of Vermont. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Christina will distribute some handouts. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Dr. Mark Cooper. I am Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and Environment and Vermont Law School. In my 30 years of public policy analysis, I have testified over 350 times before federal and state legislatures and regulatory bodies on energy and communications issues, always on behalf of consumer, low-income, public, and public interest groups, as well as people's councils and attorneys general. I appreciate the opportunity to address what I think is a really important question. Should Minnesota lift the moratorium on nuclear construction in the state? My answer is an unequivocal no, it should not. Based on several major analyses I've done over the past three years of the economics of nuclear construction and the alternatives, I believe that Minnesota should not lift the moratorium. I understand the moratorium was enacted on environmental grounds, but I believe it should stay in place on purely economic grounds. Lifting the ban will expose Minnesota ratepayers to billions of dollars of uneconomic risk. My analysis of the economics of nuclear reactors shows that the projected cost of nuclear reactors has been increasing by 10 to 15% every year for the past decade. The reason is that the advocates of nuclear power lowballed the original estimates, as they did in the 1960s and early 1970s. As a result of this constant escalation and increase of costs, nuclear reactors are totally uneconomic today. My analysis of the cost of constructing nuclear reactors in the U.S. and France, which is frequently given as some sort of role model, shows that cost escalation is an endemic part of the nuclear industry. The experience of the French in Finland and even at home in France shows that there are still cost escalation problems once construction begins. My analysis of the high costs and severe risks of nuclear reactors shows dozens of uncertainties that afflict nuclear power plants. And it is those uncertainties that have led Wall Street to refuse to finance these projects. So the nuclear industry is seeking subsidies from federal taxpayers, from state ratepayers, from foreign equipment vendors, and from foreign governments in order to build their plants. The capital markets have said no, and they want the ratepayers and taxpayers to subsidize those plants and reverse and overcome the judgment of the marketplace. If the moratorium is lifted, the people who want to build these plants will be back here and at the Public Utility Commission demanding those subsidies. The industry has said they cannot build them without construction work in progress. That is, ratepayers are forced to pay for reactors before they are used and useful. That's a no-interest loan from consumers to utilities, and ratepayers bear the risk if those plants are not completed. These huge, inflexible plants have a fundamental problem when it comes to making choices. once utilities become committed to these reactors, they become hostile to everything else. My analysis of past history and current practice is that utilities that were committed to nuclear were less likely to support renewables or efficiency. Utilities that have, in states where they have sought licenses today, have lower renewable portfolio standards, have weaker efficiency standards. The commitment to nuclear crowds out the alternatives because they are huge projects, they take up the financial resources and the management time of the utilities, and they are not interested in having other options come along that might diminish the need for these plants. And they are humongous projects that literally blot out the opportunities for alternatives. In my testimony today, I also offer you some observations on a major issue about which there is great concern, which has to do with the question of creating jobs. Nuclear reactors are, in fact, very poor at job creation when they are compared to the alternatives. Because of their high capital costs, their long lead times, they require lots of investment per job produced. Because of the expense of nuclear power, they drain the pocketbooks of consumers who have less money to spend on other goods and services. And those monies left in consumers' pockets have much higher multipliers when it comes to creating jobs in the local economy. In short, nuclear construction is a very slow way to produce a very small number of jobs compared to the alternatives. I should also point out that among the choices for carbon reduction, nuclear reactors are the most expensive. They buy you less carbon abatement per dollar of expenditure than does efficiency or renewables. So they are bad utility policy, bad economic policy, bad jobs policy, and bad environmental policy. Now, when a public policy analysis is as crystal clear as this is, I believe that simple and blunt policy instruments are the best approach. New nuclear reactors have little chance of becoming economically competitive for decades. But inserting them into the policy mix will distort the debate. There is no such thing as a level playing field when nuclear reactors are on the table. Because they are so large, they take up so much attention, they tilt the table. They crowd out the alternatives. I cannot predict when, if ever, nuclear reactors will become economically competitive. But I can say with a great deal of confidence, they are not economically competitive today, and that Minnesota has the alternatives for decades to meet their needs for electricity at lower cost in a more consumer and environmentally friendly manner, even if we have a carbon reduction policy in this country. The moratorium is good policy, and if it were not in place today, I would recommend that you adopt one. Thank you. I'll be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Cooper. Excuse me. Members, any questions? Again, a quiet group today. Thank you very much, Dr. Cooper. Tom Casey is our next testifier. Mr. Casey, whenever you're ready, please identify yourself for the record and start your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tom Casey, and I'm speaking on behalf of the West Metro Global Warming Action Group. And I hope after my brevity, you'll reward me by agreeing. And this has to do with the fact that our organization has testified in the past on the issues regarding the economic and environmental impacts of nuclear power. I'm here today to ask one question. And in preference to the one question, I'd like to say that we've heard lots of legislators and supporters talk about the need to have a conversation, to have an in-depth discussion about the pros and cons of nuclear power, and that this can only be accomplished by repealing the moratorium. This is my last chance and the public's last chance to have a formal conversation with the legislature before this is likely to be voted on. And if it is voted on, my understanding that if it passes, it goes to the floor. So this is my chance and our chance to have a conversation and for the consumers to weigh in on the results of my question. So the question is that we'd like to have before you take a vote is the following. If the moratorium is repealed, if it's repealed, how much will the ratepayers and taxpayers have to pay for this so-called conversation? We need to analyze that. And that could be the conversation. We don't know how the conversation is going to go, but I hear discussion that it might be in front of the Public Utilities Commission, maybe in the form of the plan process, the resource plans, and maybe in the form of a certificate of need process. There may be other conversations that are going that I'm not really privy to how that would occur, but we need to hear what the ratepayers and the taxpayers are going to be on the hook for that they wouldn't be if you had a conversation without the repeal. Because it seems like we had lots of conversations. As I said, I've been speaking, and my other cohorts on the NS organization have also spoke at the legislature the last two times. So we've had conversations already. So we're asking for your good faith estimate, which is, as you know, in real estate transactions, even the simplest real estate transaction, you have a good faith estimate of your closing costs. Well, this is a good faith estimate of the cost of this bill if it's adopted. I would suggest that you delay this, since we all hear about the time. We have lots of time to discuss this. You're early in the session. I suggest the following, that you hold off on your vote today and you give this 2 weeks. The first week would be the proponents of the bill come forth with their good faith estimate of what the cost to the ratepayers and the taxpayers will be. That estimate would come by email to the committee chair or their administrators and would come out to the public, taxpayers and ratepayers, we all are, to find out what we're going to be on the line for. 2 weeks from now, we have a discussion on that report, and then you can decide whether or not that conversation is in fact worth it as guardians of the ratepayers and taxpayers that you are. So I look forward to your discussion of my suggestion, and I really invite and encourage you to hold off on your vote today to do so. Do you have any questions of me before I leave?
Thank you, Mr. Casey. We have at least one question. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Casey. I agree that we should have a conversation on how much certain things cost. I agree with that. I'd like you to talk about the taxpayers being on the hook. I think we have to have a discussion of how much the taxpayers are on the hook for wind subsidies, for solar subsidies, and all those types of things. Of course, ethanol, that's a good subsidy. that's a good one, but it kind of cuts both ways.
Yeah.
And I notice your name is Global Warming Alliance, since that's been disproven that it's warming, we're actually cooling. Are you going to change your name to the West Metro Climate Change Alliance?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would entertain that suggestion, and I will bring it back to the board in good faith. And I really mean that.
That'd be good, and I'm serious, because back on the farm in Section 28, Sumner Township, Fillmore County, the temperature would go up and the temperature go down, and we call that weather. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for the report from Fillmore County. Thank you, Representative Davids. Other questions?
From Brownsdale.
Thank you. With that, thank you, Mr. Casey.
Mr. Chair, just as a quick...
Sure, Mr. Casey.
And Representative, yes, I will bring that back. There has been discussions about how to properly formulate the idea. With your support of my suggestion, I will support your suggestion to bring it back. So we have a deal here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's peace in the valley.
We always strive for peace in the valley. Thank you for helping us achieve that, Mr. Casey.
Thank you.
Mr. David List is the next on our... And if there's anybody else that wants to testify after Mr. List, either for or against the bill, anybody in the audience that wants to speak, let us know. Mr. List, if you could identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready to go.
My name is David List. I'm here as a private citizen. I live in St. Paul in District 66A. And I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to participate today. I had intended to wear a tie. It did not occur to me that this might be a political statement, but I happened to leave it behind.
Mr. Chairman Murdoch has one.
You only have one. I was going to borrow one from my union steward, but
Mr. List, you hit kind of a sore subject.
No, my apologies.
That's okay.
Before I begin, I would just like to add to second Mr. Casey's suggestion that take a couple of weeks before making a vote on this so we have time for full public participation. I also value the conversation, and I hope we can broaden the participation in that. I'm just going to summarize my comments, which I've submitted. I want to say nuclear power is a lemon. It's a lot like taking grandma's Social Security check and using it to buy her a Hummer so she can go to the grocery store. Or as the late Barry Commoner said, it's like using a chainsaw to cut butter. The nuclear power industry has only survived through massive subsidies, and I'm taking this, by the way, from some free market sources. You probably are familiar with the Cato Institute, advocates of the strongest possible free market economics. They pointed out that prior to the 2008 economic meltdown, six of the biggest investment banks, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Credit Suisse, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and Lehman Brothers, I'm not sure all of those still exist, some of the biggest risk takers on the planet, banks that saw no loan unworthy of making, told the federal government they would be glad to invest in nuclear power on the condition of an unconditional guarantee of 100% of their loans. Anything less than that was unacceptable. If the free market, if the most risky risk takers in the free market think that nuclear power is too dangerous to have anything less than 100% guarantees on their investment, why should we be taking this risk? I know I don't want to exceed time here. Just want to add that as a utility payer, I mean, I paid over $200 for my gas and electric last month in a pretty well-insulated, not terribly big house. I do not want to be on the hook for rate hikes that may come out of stranded costs, out of cost overruns. And would also point out that according to one recent economic study, nuclear construction projects have had an average of 207% over costs over their original estimates. There's no reason to think that will stop. So whatever estimate you get from the nuclear industry, double it and then hope it doesn't go higher due to other delays. Last thing I just want to add on a personal note, my wife is a cancer survivor. My brother-in-law is a cancer survivor. I've lost 5 relatives to cancer. I lost a good friend last year to cancer. My son lost a 13-year-old friend last year to cancer. We know 80% of cancers are environmentally caused. We know that nuclear waste is one of the most potent carcinogens on the planet, and we know we have no plan to dispose of it. Please do not open the floodgates to more cancer, more utility rate hikes, and more taxpayer subsidies. Don't repeal Minnesota's moratorium on nuclear power. Please vote no on House File 9. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions, members? Seeing no questions, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wanted to testify either for or against the bill? If you would like to speak, please come down, and we'll get ready to hear amendments.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead and identify yourself for record.
Kristen Idy Tollefson. I live in Florence Township, Goodhue County. Thank you for the open mic. I didn't expect that, and I do have one comment that I would like to make. I have been involved in nuclear waste politics since 1995 when I woke up and saw a newspaper that showed my township as the candidate sites for all of the sites potential for off Prairie Island waste that was part of the bill back in 1994. And I have continued to follow the waste issue since that time. I've been on several, I was on the EQB Citizens Advisory Task Force, and I've been on several several venues. And the specific thing that I want to bring to your attention right now is a fairly new development, and that is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is extending its waste confidence decision to 60 years after the closure of the plant. And has directed its staff to study up to 300 years of storage at the reactor sites, because we really have no idea what plan might ever evolve for the waste, and they see it as the most efficient and economical to leave it at the reactor sites as long as possible. Now, there are two factors for this. The engineering studies for Yucca Mountain show that if the waste is left at reactor sites, that the facility and casks will need to be replaced at least 50 to 100 years, each 50 to 100 years, and we have no plans whatsoever for long-term storage. The comment that was made in the NRC letter regarding having the staff study 300-year extension is that they knew that there really may not be provisions, and that there could be burdens, there could be economic burdens for both the state and local governments that may result from this initiative, but that the recourse that they would suggest is that they could sue the federal government for compensation. So I would say this is not a plan that is, we have no Yucca Mountain, we have no central storage, and with this kind of speculation at the federal level about potential impacts of long-term storage to our state, I hope you will consider this as a very, is something that we as local people and friends of the Mississippi River take very seriously, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Members, any questions? Seeing none, we'll move into amendments. And I think the first one we want to do is the A-10 amendment. And I assume that's...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Manzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A-10 amendment deals with the issue of storage. The A-10 amendment actually came to mind because it has become the state's ongoing policy that we store spent nuclear fuel in caskets at Monticello and caskets at Prairie Island. And the ones at Prairie Island are in fact on an island in the Mississippi River, about 500-600 yards away from a local government center and a child care center. And it just seems to me that it would be wise for us, before we make our decision and take our votes, which ultimately could lead to construction of another reactor somewhere and the production of additional waste, additional spent fuel, that we ought to give our constituents, all of us on the committee, that we ought to give our constituents the opportunity by referendum to say, yes, we are open and ready to receive spent nuclear fuel in our communities, or no, we don't support the possible eventuality of storing spent nuclear fuel in our communities. So if you look at the amendment, I have each of our House districts listed, and the sum and substance of the amendment would be that if this moves forward, and I think it will, that we, at a minimum, give our citizens an opportunity to vote by referendum whether or not they would like to have spent nuclear fuel, the additional spent nuclear fuel, stored in their community. So that's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Representative Pepin, did you want to respond to that? We also have Representative Davids has a question.
Well, I would ask members not to support this amendment. First of all, I think we need to keep in mind that, you know, part of the reason the PUC was created was because they have the ability and the technical expertise to be able to look at the options and to be able to evaluate everything and give us the proper information before they'd make any recommendations. So they're looking out for us to figure out what the best alternatives we have are. And I would also point out that in that process, in that certificate of need process, there is a requirement that there's local public input. And so I don't think this is needed. There would be time for it, and I think that we really need to trust in the PUC to make those decisions.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move to amend the amendment. We have this little thing called redistricting. I'm concerned that 31B and 3A might be gerrymandered together somehow here, and so that this really wouldn't hold true. Of course, I would run again because I don't like getting beat by the incumbent there. But with that being said, I would move to amend on line 1.5, strike the words "of the following," and then line 1.6, insert a period after "referendum." So we could still have the referendum, but it wouldn't be specific to a district. That's not going to work, just because in a year we're going to be redistricting a different district. So I would move the amendment to the amendment.
Representative Davids moves the amendment to the amendment. Representative Pepin, do you want to speak to that amendment to the amendment?
Well, and thank you, Representative Davids. I think the amendment should just be voted down, and whether or not you vote for this, it's irrelevant to me. I think the whole amendment should be voted down.
Well, Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids brings up a good point here about redistricting. However, we are still going to have a District 3A and a District 3B and a District 8B and a District 14A and so on and so forth. So I would urge members not to support the amendment to the amendment. And I would urge members to keep in mind that, well, frankly, Representative Pepin, you know, you talked about the PUC and reminds me of, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. I think it's far better in the case of additional creation of spent nuclear fuel to give our citizens the opportunity to say yes or no. And at the end of the day, those of us on the committee and in the body that are supportive of removing the moratorium may find this to be advantageous to the cause. So I'd ask members to oppose the amendment to the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Davids, I think I know what you're getting at. I just want to make certain it's a, with your proposed amendment, it would state, or a spent nuclear fuel storage facility in any House legislative districts unless the construction has been approved by referendum. Would that be in that particular legislative district? Is that what you're getting at?
Well,
you're not talking about a statewide referendum in order to put it in 39B.
Representative Davids.
No, what it would do is any legislative district that the way my language, first of all, Mr. Chairman, I need to have a friendly amendment to my amendment, and on line 1.5, change the word district to, or this could be included in my amendment to the amendment, because I can't amend an amendment to the amendment to the amendment. So
right.
It would be
exactly.
Change districts to district.
Yeah.
So it would be a legislative district. And then, Mr. Chairman, my intent here would be to pass my amendment and then encourage the committee to vote down the amendment that I just cleaned up.
Well, thank you for fixing that, Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, can I just suggest, since I can't amend an amendment to the amendment, that on line 1.6, after the word referendum, you add "in that particular House district."
That would be friendly.
So that's we're not amending the amendment to the amendment. We're having a friendly suggestion to improve the amendment to the amendment without amending,
which
he's accepted. Is everybody clear on that? Please vote no on this. Any other questions, any other discussion on this amendment to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, we'd appreciate a roll call, please.
Representative Atkins has requested a roll call on the amendment to the amendment. There will be a roll call. Whenever you're ready.
Hoppe?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Atkins?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Sarah Anderson? Yes.
No.
Anderson S? No. Anzels?
No.
Crawford?
No.
Doubt?
No.
Davids?
Yes.
Dietrich?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Kiefer?
No.
Lilly?
No.
Loon?
No.
Mazerell?
No.
Mullery?
No.
Murdoch?
No.
Nelson?
No.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Slocum?
No.
Stensrud?
No.
Tilbury?
No.
It's got to bring people together.
So much for the valley being peaceful on that one.
Well, and he had bipartisan support on the amendment to the amendment. By a roll call vote of 2-20, the amendment to the amendment does not prevail. We are back on to the amendment. Any further discussion on the Anzell's A-10 amendment?
Mr. Chair, we'd request roll call.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
Hoppe?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Atkins?
Aye.
Anderson D? Anderson S?
No.
Anzels?
Yes.
Crawford?
No.
Doubt?
No.
Davids?
No.
Dietrich?
Yes.
Johnson?
Yes.
Kiefer?
No.
Lilly?
Yes.
Loon?
No.
Mazerell?
No.
Mullery?
Aye.
Murdoch?
No.
Nelson?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Slocum?
Yes.
Stensrud?
No.
Tilbury?
Yes.
By a count of 9-13, the amendment does not prevail. We move on to the next amendment, which I believe is the A8 amendment. The A8 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. There we are. I was
way
wondering
down
who was
here in the South 40.
Well, amendments are always welcome from the South 40.
Good.
To your amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids is going to love this, and he's going to walk out of the room. You're going to love this amendment.
He's coming over to sit by you.
I'm thinking. This amendment comes, I had the opportunity last spring to tour Prairie Island. XL Energy asked me to come, extended an invitation, and I took him up on it. And I toured with Representative Downey and with Senator Vandeveer, and we went through, and it was a very thorough and complete tour. Then I went next door to the Prairie Island Indian community, and what I heard in the plant itself was, look at this, this is so safe, this is so safe. When I had to put my feet on the footprints and be checked for radiation upon leaving the plant, I was a little concerned. When I went next door, I was even more concerned because they told me that the casks that we saw that were surrounded by just chain link fence were 400 feet from some of the Indian housing. And I don't think that's right, and it hasn't been a good relationship. So this amendment comes from that experience. I should also say, a lot of people don't know a whole lot about me, and I like that. But I also walked the protest line 35 years ago at Monticello. So I come with some baggage on nuclear. Anyway, my amendment says that unless in line 1, or page 1, line 7, before the period, unless the construction has been approved by referendum in each statutory and home rule charter city, town, and township located within 25 miles of the proposed construction site. And what this does is it gives local control, something we all support. I know there's open land in Ridgefield and in Bloomington, the cities I represent, and I would really like my people to be able to vote as to whether they wanted a facility like this in their community. So that's, in essence, the amendment.
Nice job. Thank you, Representative Slocum. Any questions on that, members?
Mr. Chair, we'd request a roll call, please.
I was going to ask. Representative Pepin, to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Slocum. I would, for the same reasons as the last amendment, I would oppose this amendment. You know, I think these decisions need to be made by the PUC. They have the technical expertise to be able to determine where the best sites are, and the local communities will have an opportunity to be in that process, and I think that's the proper place to address it.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. Roll call having been requested, we'll have a roll call.
Hoppe?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Atkins?
Yes.
Anderson D?
No.
Anderson S? Anzels?
Yes.
Crawford?
No.
Dowett?
No.
Davids?
No.
Dietrich?
Yes.
Johnson?
Yes.
Kiefer?
No. No.
Lilly?
Yes.
Loon?
No.
Mazerell?
No.
Mullery?
Aye.
Murdoch?
No.
Nelson?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Slocum?
Yes.
Stensrud?
No.
Tilbury?
Yes.
By the increasingly familiar score of 9 to 13, the amendment does not prevail. To the next amendment, which I believe is the A13 amendment.
That one's mine, Mr. Chairman. And at the risk of the definition of insanity, where you try the same thing over and over and hope for a different outcome, what the heck? And this one, Representative Pepin, if I might, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate a little help.
Excuse me, which amendment are you on?
The A13 amendment.
A13, okay.
It's the one that references the 10th Amendment at the top and our support for the 10th Amendment. My question, the Price-Anderson Nuclear Industries Indemnity Act, does that fully protect Minnesotans in the event of an accident?
Representative Pepin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. I was going to actually ask the author of this amendment some questions because I have a hard time understanding how this would actually work. My understanding is that the Price-Anderson Act would require and does require the nuclear power plant owners to carry $375 million in private insurance for off-site liability coverage for each reactor. And then it also requires a structure to be put in place whereby the 104 nuclear power plants that we already have pool their money so that there would be a $12.6 billion total coverage for any incident in any nuclear power plant, and that's done without taxpayer funding. And so I guess I would have a question for you if you could maybe explain how your amendment would work. To me, when I'm reading it, it looks like you're wanting to waive the indemnification, and I'm not sure why that would be a good deal and why that would be responsible. And I also was very confused on your lines 122 and 123, if you could explain that.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, what happens in the event that there's an accident that causes damages and injuries in excess of $12.6 billion?
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to point out that that has never happened. That's very unlikely to happen. No taxpayer funding has ever been required in response to a nuclear incident. There's never been any deaths, near deaths. It's been one of the safest industries. My understanding that it would be only if the damages exceeded $12.6 billion would the federal government become liable for any of the damages.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, federal government meaning the taxpayers. Do you support taxpayer bailout of a private industry that causes harm to individuals?
Representative Pepin.
No, but perhaps an expert could tell us how much, if there were to have an incident, how much that cost would be. But I'm guessing we're working on the amendment, so maybe you could explain your amendment so I can help better understand where you're headed with this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins.
Thank you. Representative Pepin, I think you've made my point. In the event of a nuclear accident, by the way, I support the bill. I believe that we should be allowed to have the conversation. I find it offensive that we can't have the conversation. Legislators ought to be able to talk about anything we want to. And on virtually any other topic, we're allowed to do that. So I support the bill. I'll wait. My point is in the event of, and I don't know how big a nuclear accident could be. Three Mile Island cost, I believe, $156 million in damages. But in the event of a tragedy, if there was, in fact, $12.6 billion or more in damages, what the Price-Anderson Nuclear Industries Indemnity Act calls for is a federal bailout of private industry. And if that's what you should support, then you should support the price, you know, continuing that practice. But if you believe, like I do, that people ought to be responsible for their own actions, then you ought to vote for the amendment. That is the point of my amendment.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps we can, again, maybe we can have Mr. Pickens or someone come down to talk about how much has been paid out. That would be, I think, an enlightening answer. I would ask, though, since I've been asked to comment on the amendment, what your intention with the actual amendment. The way I'm reading it, it's asking you to waive indemnification, limited liability, conferred to the licensee, and then it's asking them, to obtain private sources to get their insurance. But on 22 and 23, I'm confused. It looks like you're excluding any ratepayer costs. So then how, under this mechanism, how would the licensee then pay for insurance? Is it your intention not for them to have to pay insurance? I'm just technically, if you could maybe help me understand how this would technically work.
Representative Beck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I'd be happy to.
Okay.
First off, what it calls for is for a private entity to be privately insured, not to count on some federal bailout, the taxpayers of the Minnesota and the rest of the country, to bail them out in the event of a problem. But secondly, it would call upon the shareholders, not the ratepayers. I don't think the ratepayers should be responsible for buying that insurance. It ought to be those that are actively involved, investors in that entity. They ought to be the ones to pay for the insurance, don't you think?
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, no, I don't think the shareholders will. I think that would kill the industry. But I think I would like to have maybe Mr. Pickens come down or someone come down to talk about how much has been paid out, because I think that was a good question, and
Mr. Chair,
we can explore that further.
I believe it's $156 million. That's what was paid out at Three Mile Island. But the other question, if you want to invite Mr. Pickens down, I'm sure he'd welcome the chance to join us on this and tell us whether or not it's possible that there could be a nuclear accident that would cost Minnesotans in excess of $12.6 billion. I'm interested to hear that answer. But the other answer I'd be curious to find out is whether or not the Price-Anderson Nuclear Industries Indemnity Act actually would cover a willful act of misconduct. If somebody willfully did wrong, would the taxpayers of the United States and of Minnesota be expected to pick up the tab for their willful misconduct? And be careful on that answer, because I already know the answer, Mr. Pickens. But, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it up to Mr. Pickens and Representative
Mr. Pepin. Pickens.
For the record, my name is Terry Pickens. I'm the Director of Nuclear Regulatory Policy for Xcel Energy. Price-Anderson, first let me answer the number that I've seen the accounting for says $71 million has been paid out as a result of Three Mile Island. So that was paid out of the primary insurance held by the owner-operator. It did not go into the secondary pool. So it was covered by the primary insurance of the owner-operator of Three Mile Island at that time. I guess I'm going to have to say I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know what covers willful and not willful, so I'm not capable of answering that question. So if I tried, I don't know if I'd get it right or not.
Mr. Pickens, since Representative Atkins said he already knows the answer, I think you're taking the safe course there. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pickens, I appreciate your coming down, and I appreciate the answer. The fact is Price-Anderson does, in fact, cover gross negligence and willful misconduct by private entities. So if they intentionally, willfully cause a problem, willfully engage in misconduct, it says that the taxpayers of the United States and of Minnesota would be required to bail them out. That's what the law says. So this, all the amendment says is that we're not going to abide by that. We're believers in the 10th Amendment. We're going to thumb our noses at the feds, tell them they're wrong. And if we're going to get into this business again, which I support having the conversation, then darn it, if you want to get into the business, you ought to be able to stand behind your product and be taken or be fully accountable if you have a problem, willful or not. And with that, I'd appreciate your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, am not a lawyer, but I'm getting a little confused between, at the end, ultimately, fiduciary responsibility of three different groups now. The shareholders in investor-owned utilities, the ratepayer, which is all of us, and then this notion of the taxpayer who may or may not be part of the investor-owned utilities service delivery territory. Can you, either of you, give me some clarity as to who does pay? Taxpayer, ratepayer, or investor?
Mr. Pickens?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the way it is set up, we hold $375 million in primary insurance. We, Xcel Energy, are responsible for holding that. We pass the cost on for that insurance on through rates. So our ratepayers are paying the insurance premiums that we pay to maintain that primary insurance. Price Anderson then has a structure whereby the 104 operating nuclear reactors would pool their insurance in the event of a nuclear incident at any reactor. If something happened in Pennsylvania, Illinois, Minnesota, and it exceeded the primary coverage of Xcel Energy, if it was in Minnesota, then what would happen is the nuclear industry, through that pooled structure that's put in place by Price Anderson, we would, from $375 million up to the $12.6 million, would be paid for through that pool that is provided there. Now, if you exceeded, and in answer to your question, Representative Atkins, it is possible that there could be an incident at a nuclear power plant that could cause damages in excess of the $12.6 billion. The likelihood of such an event is very small, and I think that there was a lot of debate when Price Anderson was put in place as to whether or not, for a high consequence, low probability event, requiring somebody to go out and get private insurance to cover that amount would be very expensive. So they felt that the way to go, I think expecting that it would never be invoked, was to then have the federal government guarantee it above that amount. So that's kind of how that structure got put in place.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Mr. Pickens talking about the actual payout. Just a little quick calculation, $71 million. That's 0.58% of the $12.6 billion. So that's what was spent in the Three Mile Island payout. I hope that gives you a good frame of reference. So I think that this is this amendment is reckless, and I don't know where I got that word from today for some reason. So I would encourage members to vote against this.
Well, thank you, Representative Pepin. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, we will vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the A13 amendment signify.
Sure, we asked for a roll call.
Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies. I should have remembered to ask anyhow. Roll call having been requested and the chair forgetting, there will be a roll call. Bethany, proceed whenever you're ready.
Hoppe?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Atkins?
Aye.
Anderson D?
No.
Anderson S?
No.
Anzels?
Yes.
Crawford?
No.
Doubt?
No.
Davids?
No.
Dietrich?
Yes.
Johnson?
Yes.
Kiefer?
No.
Lilly?
Yes.
Loon?
No.
Masrell?
No.
Mullery?
Aye.
Murdoch?
No.
Nelson?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Slocum?
Yes.
Stensrud?
No.
Tilbury?
Yes.
Again, members, it's the now familiar 9 to 13. By a vote of 9 to 13, the motion does not prevail. On to the A14 amendment. Who's offering the Representative Nelson, the A14.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to offer the A14 amendment. And basically what this does is is if the cost of building this exceeds 200% of the original projected budget amount of the cost, that it would not fall back on the ratepayers of the state of Minnesota, that it would fall back on, in that case, it would fall back on the investors in the plant. Again, this is private companies that, and private investors that investor-owned utility that they should suffer some of the risk of this if the cost goes above the 200%, and that's what the amendment is in a nutshell.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Members, questions? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I just wanted to point out first that I read in a news release somewhere that plants across the country have experienced enormous cost overruns, and that's not the information that I'm seeing. I'm seeing that the plants that are under current construction are right on schedule, and I know Mr. Pickens has more he could say on that if you'd like. I think that this just creates too much risk, and I think it would make it very difficult to build, and so I would speak in opposition, ask you to vote in opposition to this amendment.
Representative Nelson?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, if that's the case, if they're being built on time and on budget, and then this should not cause any heartache for anybody that wants to build one of these plants, because if it's being built on time and on budget, we're not going to get to 200%. So I think this in favor of it. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any other questions, any commentary on this amendment? Seeing none, we will vote on the A14 amendment.
Hoppe?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Atkins?
Aye.
Anderson D?
No.
Anderson S?
No.
Anzels?
Yes.
Crawford?
No.
Dowett?
No.
Davids?
Okay.
Dietrich? Johnson?
Yes.
Kiefer?
No.
Lilly?
Yes.
Loon?
No.
Masrell?
No.
Mullery?
Aye.
Murdoch?
No.
Nelson?
Definitely yes.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Slocum?
Yes.
Stensrud?
No.
Tilbury?
Yes.
Members, the motion does not prevail. The vote was 9 to 13. We are now on to the last amendment, the A12 amendment, which is Representative Atkins, to your amendment.
I'd request a roll call on the A12 amendment, Mr. Chair. I might start, Representative Pepin, is this, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, is this one that you can support? Because I can be much briefer if it's just one that you think is a good idea.
Representative Pepin.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I do have actually some sympathy towards this, because I think your intention of the money being spent in the way it was meant to be spent is certainly a good idea. My concern with your amendment is the ramifications, and that's why I can't support it. I'm concerned about what would happen if we breached the contract. What would happen? Would we be able to still, once the site is in place, would that take us out of the queue to be able to store our waste? And so I'm intrigued by the idea. I don't think we should support it today, because I think I would like to have Mr. Pickens talk a little bit more about the strong repercussions of this, but I can certainly sympathize with what you're trying to do. It is very frustrating that they're spending this money in a way they shouldn't be spending the money.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, and I won't beat it to death. I'll try to be relatively brief with respect to it. Even I appreciate your sympathy, but I'd rather have your vote. Folks probably are aware of the whole Yucca Mountain fiasco. 1982, the Fed said that they were going to build a national repository, permanent repository for spent nuclear waste. It was going to be open by 1998. Minnesota has been asked to contribute ratepayers that reside in areas that are served by nuclear power. Have contributed with interest in excess of $600 million. That's just for Minnesota. And they're being asked to continue to pay even though Yucca Mountain has now been defunded. It's no longer even a prospect. Stephen Chu, the Energy Secretary, took it off. It's not going to happen. They have no other plan. We've on average paid over $575 per ratepayer into this fund that is not going to happen. And now they're being asked, as Representative Pepin, I think, or one of the testifiers said, to look out 300 years for these temporary waste sites here in Minnesota, many of which are relatively close to some of your districts. If you're on the river, for example, you can imagine what's going on upstream. We're now approaching the 20-year manufacturer's warranty on the temporary casks in which the waste is currently stored. We're still being asked to pay into this fund again and again and again. Already over $30 billion have been paid in nationally. It's time for somebody to tell the feds to go get lost. That until they keep their end of the bargain, there's no sense, you know, it's basic breach of contract law. If they don't keep their end of the bargain, we're not required to keep our end of the bargain. And as long as we continue to pay them, I don't think that they've got any motivation to ever get anything done. This amendment is very simple. It says if we, in fact, go down this route and we build a new nuclear plant, we're not going to pay into that fund until and unless they open and operate a permanent repository for the toxic waste. At least do that much for your constituents. For heaven's sakes, we've already said that they can't even vote on it. You're going to put it in their backyards, they don't get to vote on that. At least say that we're not going to open it until there's a spot for the darn waste to go. That's what the amendment does. With that, I appreciate your support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Members, any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Pepin.
I think, Mr. Pickens, I think it's important that we have a full understanding of what happens if it were to happen, and I think he can more fully explain what the problem is here.
Mr. Pickens.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, in fact, the statute, federal statute that governs the Nuclear Waste Fund, specifically requires the Department of Energy and any owner-operators of nuclear power plants in the country to enter a contract. And that contract and statute both recognize the payments into the Nuclear Waste Fund require that. So if we were to, in fact, stop paying, divert the money, and put it into an escrow account, that would put us in breach of federal statute. That would also put us in breach of our contract. In the contract and the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, there's a number of different things that get triggered if you don't have a valid contract. And that includes, as was mentioned, the order of the queue. It could even bring into question access to a federal repository. When they complete one someday, they could turn to us and say, we're not obligated to accept your waste. Minnesota, take care of it yourself. So it could mean that we have to do the repository itself. It also has worked into it that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who we hold a operating license from, that there are decisions that they make with regard to our license that unless we have a valid contract in place, they cannot take those actions. So it could bring into question certain actions at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So there's a whole series of things as a result of us withholding payments and going into breach that would be triggered, and those are the things that concern us.
Thank you, Mr. Pickens. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Mr. Pickens pretty thoroughly covered, I think, some points I thought were valid to bring out with regards to the risks. And I would say to Representative Atkins, I think, at face value, you're right. We're paying for something we're not getting. But there are some risks associated with taking this action. And there is a lawsuit currently pending, as I understand as well. And do we have any notion about when a decision might be rendered on that?
Mr. Pickens?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in fact, we are in our second round of lawsuits seeking damages. We have been awarded in our first lawsuit damages to recover the cost of the dry cast storage that we've had to put in place at Prairie Island. We have not received a check yet. That's under appeal by the Department of Energy. We are in the second lawsuit. That will be going to argument, I think, later on this year. And right now, the reason that we can enter those damages is because the federal government is in partial breach. If we went into breach, then that would jeopardize us receiving any money back probably from those lawsuits.
Any further? Any further discussion to the amendment?
Just final point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
I applaud Mr. Pickens. With all due respect, he does a fine job of explaining the risks. But think through what those risks are. We're not getting anything now. We have nothing at risk. We will lose our place in line. There is no line. We won't be able to put our stuff in the new national facility. There is no national facility. It's like buying we bought a car 28 years ago and been paying on it, never got the car. It defies common sense to just keep pouring good money after bad when we're in a situation like this, and to be sending it off to Washington, D.C. Defies any notion of common sense whatsoever. So if what we've been doing isn't working, and you'd think, by the way, that we would learn from it because we keep losing votes over here 9-13. Yeah. I'm learning, folks. What we've been doing ain't working. It isn't working on the amendment strategy over here, and it ain't working to send all this money off to Washington, D.C. So tell them to go suck rocks, and let's see them come after us for the money. We'll escrow it. We'll keep it aside. If it does open, we'll send it off to them. Support the amendment.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. One other thing I wanted to point out, another concern that I had, is that because of the contracts, I'm worried that the utilities would probably have to pay twice because they would still, under their contractual obligations, have to pay. So I think that this could potentially require them to pay twice, which is obviously going to have an effect on ratepayers.
Representative Van Zyl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually done with all of this, but I heard, Mr. Pickens, you used the term or the word dry in front of casket and storage. Does that mean that we have storage in wet caskets as well?
Mr. Pickens.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have two storage methods at the plant. When it comes out of the reactor, it is first placed into wet storage, which is a large pool, and it is kept in that pool for 10 to 12 years until it cools. After it is cooled sufficiently, then it is eligible to be put into dry cast storage. The original plan was to only use the pool. At the time, once the federal government did not show up on time, though, we had to come up with an alternative method. We didn't expand the pool. We had already re-racked it and come up with as much storage capacity inside the wet storage that we could, and so then we moved to a dry storage system. So we have wet storage and dry storage on site.
Representative Van Zyl.
And it's the dry casket storage that is in close proximity to the tribal government center and the child care center.
Mr. Pickens.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the dry cast storage is on the plant site proper, as is the spent fuel pool, and yes, the Prairie Island Indian Community Reservation is adjacent to the plant site, and I believe it's about a half mile to the nearest resident from the Prairie Island Indian Community to the dry spent fuel storage facility.
Thank you.
Any further questions, members? Well, Representative Atkins renews his motion for the A12 amendment. Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
Hoppe?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Atkins?
Aye.
Anderson D?
No.
Anderson S?
No.
Anzelt?
Yes.
Crawford?
No.
Doubt?
No.
Davids?
No.
Dietrich?
Yes.
Johnson?
Yes.
Kiefer?
No.
Lilly?
Yes.
Loon?
No.
Mazrell?
No.
Mullery?
No.
Murdoch?
No.
Nelson?
Yes.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Slocum?
Yes.
Stensrud?
No.
Tilbury?
Yes.
by the now familiar score of 9 to 13, the motion does not prevail. Members, we are back on the bill. Any further comments or questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that didn't get a chance to speak earlier for or against the bill? Seeing none and no further comments from members? Okay.
No.
Mr. Chairman, I have one.
Representative Diedrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a question, I think, for Representative Pippen, unless you would like to give it to somebody else. I really, you know, vacillate back and forth on this whole topic. I think most people believe that nuclear power needs to be a part of our energy package at some point or another. Today we have focused mostly on the cost. And what I am actually more concerned about is the storage, because that just even kind of seems to be the response from people on the street. Well, we haven't found a place to store that yet. And I know somebody in my community who is really involved on the environmental issues made the comment at one time that if we take away this moratorium, that might seem on the national front as more of an interest in nuclear power, and that Minnesota could potentially be the site for the storage, because we have some of the oldest rock formations and hardest rock formations in the country. Have you ever heard that, or do you ever fear that or think about that? Has that ever entered your mind, or would you help me? You've studied this a lot longer than I have.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Diedrich, you know, you hear all sorts of rumors and talk and whatnot, and I can't say that I have heard concretely one way or the other. I mean, I think it's encouraging that President Obama's put together a Blue Ribbon Commission to study the storage issue, and they're supposed to have a report out this summer. And I think, and I appreciate that you've really given this a lot of thought. I know you have. And I think overall, I guess this, maybe I'll take this, it's kind of a time for closing comments too. I think overall, this repeal of the moratorium is really an attempt to kind of make a baby step to, as you said, to make sure all of our options on the table. We've heard a lot about the cost today. I have, you know, I take some issue with some of the comments about cost, because I think there's a lot of industries that are subsidized, wind and solar, and there's efficiency issues there that have to be taken into account. But I think that if the PUC can't look at nuclear, and right now we've got the ban on coal, I don't know how that could be a value to the taxpayers, because you're not looking at all the options. You're not playing with the full deck. And I think this is just kind of a step to say, you know, we understand that we have a huge need for the future. Our electricity needs are going up. I still, for one, want to have the lights on, and I want to live in a warm house. And the fact of the matter is, the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time, and we need to keep all of our options open. So I don't have a specific answer to your question. I've heard lots of rumors. I'm glad that the Obama administration is working on the storage issue. That's certainly an issue we need to consider. But keep in mind too that even if we remove the ban today, it would be many, many, many years before this would even happen. I just think that this needs to be in the mix so that the PUC can look at all their options and make the best possible recommendations to move the state forward. Thank you.
Representative Van Zyls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as many of you know, I'm from up north, and we are at the epicenter of the major ineptitude on the part of an alphabet soup of government agencies who are involved in permitting taconite expansions, non-ferrous mining, forestry, and all of the natural resource-based economies that we are in so desperate need of. In that case, the project proposers are paying the costs of the environmental permitting. I'm concerned that in this case, if at the end of the day the moratorium is lifted, and at the end of the day an investor-owned utility changes its resource plan And if at the end of the day there's a spike in the need for baseload energy, and if at the end of the day an investor-owned utility decides to construct another reactor, it's the ratepayer that will pay and pay and pay and pay for permitting. Now, I'm going to support the streamlined permitting bill that we're going to deal with soon, and I hope all of you do. But that still will... Can you imagine the lengthy delays in permitting a nuclear reactor? And in this case, it's our ratepayers who are already under pressure, already having a tough time paying rates, especially in rural Minnesota, who would pay an unreasonable amount of the price. So for that reason, in addition to the storage, as you might expect, I'm not going to support lifting the moratorium.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Members, any further questions before we take a vote?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Can we have a roll call, please?
Roll call having been requested, we will have a roll call. Whenever you're ready. I think before we do the roll call, just to make it official, I think I should renew my motion that, what are we on, Senate File 4? Senate File 4, as amended, be passed and general register and go to the general register. Whenever you're ready.
Hoppe?
Yes.
Sanders?
Yes.
Atkins?
Aye.
Anderson D?
Yes.
Anderson S? Anzeltz?
No.
Crawford?
Yes.
Doubt?
Yes.
Davids?
Yes.
Dietrich?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Kiefer?
Yes.
Lilly?
No.
Loon?
Yes.
Masrell?
Yes.
Mullery? No. Murdoch?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Slocum?
No.
Stensrud?
Yes.
Tilbury?
No.
You're going to call it 13-9?
Wait for the official count. I lost track.
Same result. Same result.
Mr. Chair, I would just note that it's your side that doesn't trust your hearing now. So... We were comfortable with voice vote, but
the motion does prevail on a roll call vote of 6-6. Motion passes. Congratulations, Representative Pepin. Members, thank you.
Thank you,
we are adjourned.